He himself knew they were unjust. Then Atreyu said softly, "I thought we were friends."
"You were right," Bastian cried. "We are, and always will be. Forgive me. I've been talking nonsense."
Atreyu smiled.
"You'll have to forgive us, too, for hurting your feelings. We didn't mean it."
"Anyway," said Bastian, "I'm going to take your advice." After a while, the three knights returned with several partridges, a pheasant, and a hare. When the party started out again, Bastian was riding Yika. In the afternoon, they came to a forest consisting entirely of tall, straight evergreens, which formed high overhead a green roof so dense that a ray of sunlight seldom reached the ground. That may have been why there was no underbrush. The soft, smooth forest floor was pleasant to ride on. Falcor had resigned himself to trotting along with the company, because if he had flown above the treetops with Atreyu, he would undoubtedly have lost sight of the others. All afternoon they rode through the dark green twilight. Toward nightfall, they spied a ruined castle on a hilltop. They climbed up to it, and in the midst of all the crumbling walls and turrets, halls and passageways, they found a vaulted chamber that was in fairly good condition. There they settled down for the night. It was red-headed Husbolt's turn to cook, and he proved to be much better at it than his predecessor. The pheasant he roasted over the fire was as tasty as you could please. The next morning they resumed their journey. All day they rode through the forest, which looked the same on all sides. It was late in the day when they noticed that they must have been riding in a great circle, for ahead of them they saw the ruins of the castle they had left in the morning, but this time they were approaching it from a different direction.
"This has never happened to me before," said Hukrion, twirling his black moustache. "I can't believe my eyes," grumbled Husbolt, stalking through the ruins on his long, thin legs.
But so it was. The remains of yesterday's dinner left no room for doubt. Atreyu and Falcor said nothing, but their thoughts were hard at work. How could they have made such a mistake? At the evening meal, this time it was roast hare, prepared more or less competently by Hukrion, the three knights asked Bastian if he would care to impart some of his memories of the world he came from. Bastian excused himself by saying he had a sore throat, and since he had been very quiet all that day, the knights believed him. After suggesting a few effective remedies, they lay down to sleep. Only Atreyu and Falcor suspected what Bastian was thinking. Early in the morning, they started off again. All day they rode through the forest, trying their best to keep going in a straight line. But at nightfall, they were back at the same ruined castle.
"Well, I'll be!"
Hukrion blustered.
"I'm going mad!" groaned Husbolt. "Friends," said Hudorn disgustedly, "we might as well throw our licenses in the trash bin. Some knight's errant we turned out to be."
On their first night at the castle, Bastian, knowing that Yika liked to be alone with her thoughts now and then, had found her a special little niche. The company of the horses, who could think of nothing to talk about but their distinguished ancestry, upset her. That night, after Bastian had taken her back to her place, she said to him,
"Master, I know why we're not getting ahead."
"How can you know that, Yika?"
"Because I carry you, Master. And because I'm only half an ass, I feel certain things."
"So, according to you, why is it?"
"You don't want to get ahead, Master. You've stopped wishing for anything."
Bastian looked at her in amazement. "You are really a wise animal, Yika." The mule flapped her long ears in embarrassment.
"Do you know which way we've been going?"
"No," said Bastian. "Do you?" Yika nodded.
"We've been heading for the center of Fantastica."
"For the Ivory Tower?"
"Yes, Master. And we made good headway as long as we kept going in that direction."
"That's not possible," said Bastian. "Atreyu would have noticed it."
and certainly Falcor would have.
But they didn't.
We mules, said Yika, are simple creatures, not in a class with luck dragons, but we do have certain gifts, and one of them is a sense of direction. We never go wrong. That's how I knew for sure that you wanted to visit the childlike empress.
Moonchild, Bastian murmured. Yes, I would like to see her again. She'll tell me what to do.
Then he stroked the mule's white nose and whispered,
Thanks, Yika, thanks.
Next morning, Atreo took Bastian aside.
Listen, Bastian, Falcor and I want to apologize. The advice we gave you was meant well, but it was stupid. We just haven't been getting ahead. Falcor and I talked it over last night. You'll be stuck here, and so will we, until you wish for something. It's bound to make you lose some more of your memory, but that can't be helped. There's nothing else you can do. We can only hope that you find the way back before it's too late. It won't do you any good to stay here. You'll just have to think of your next wish and use Orin's power.
Right, said Bastian. Yika said the same thing. And I already know what my next wish will be.
Let's go. I want you all to hear it.
They rejoined the others.
Friends, said Bastian in a loud voice, so far we've been looking in vain for the way back to my world. Now I've decided to go and see the one person who can help me find it. That one person is the childlike empress. Our destination is now the Ivory Tower.
Hurrah!
Cried the three knights in unison. But then Falcor's bronze voice rang out.
Don't do it, Bastian Balthazar Books. What you wish is impossible. Don't you know that no one can meet the golden-eyed commander of wishes more than once? You will never see her again.
Bastian clenched his fists.
Moonchild owes me a lot, he said angrily. I'm sure she won't keep me away.
You'll see, Falcor replied, that her decisions are sometimes hard to understand.
Bastian felt the color rising to his cheeks.
You and Atreyu, he said, are always giving me advice. You can see where your advice has got us. From now on, I'll do the deciding. I've made up my mind, and that's that.
He took a deep breath and went on a little more calmly.
Besides, you always speak from your point of view. You two are fantasticans, and I'm a human. How can you be sure that the same rules apply to me as to you? It was different when Atreyu had Orin. And who else but me is going to give the gem back to Moonchild? No one can meet her twice, you say. But I've already met her twice. The first time we saw each other for only a moment, when Atreyu went into her chamber, and the second time when the big egg exploded. With me, everything is different. I will see her a third time.
All were silent. The knights, because they didn't know what it was all about. Atreyu and Falcor, because they were beginning to have doubts.
Well, said Atreyu finally, maybe you're right. We have no way of knowing how the childlike empress will deal with you.
After that, they started out, and before noon, they reached the edge of the forest. Before them lay sloping meadows as far as the eye could see. Soon they came to a winding river and followed its course. Again, Atreyu and Falcor explored the country, describing wide circles around their slow-moving companions. But both were troubled, and their flight was not as light and carefree as usual. Looking ahead, they saw that the country changed abruptly at a certain point in the distance. A steep slope led from the plateau to a low-lying, densely wooded plain, and the river descended the slope in a mighty waterfall. Knowing that the riders couldn't hope to get that far before the next day, the two scouts turned back.
Falcor, Atreyu asked, do you suppose the childlike empress cares what becomes of Bastian?
Maybe not, said Falcor. She draws no distinctions.
Then, said Atreyu, she is really a...
Don't say it, Falcor broke in. I know what you mean, but don't say it.
For a while Atreyu was silent. Then he said, but he's my friend, Falcor. We've got to help him, even against the childlike Empress's will if we have to. But how?
With luck, the dragon replied.
And for the first time, the bronze bell of his voice seemed to have sprung a crack. That evening, the company chose a deserted log cabin on the riverbank as their night lodging. For Falcor, of course, it was too small, and he preferred to sleep on the air. The horses and Yika also had to stay outside. During the evening meal, Atreyu told the others about the waterfall and the abrupt change in the country. Then he added, casually, by the way, we're being followed. The three knights exchanged glances.
Oho!
Cried Hukrian, giving his black moustache a martial twirl.
How many are there?
I counted 7 behind us, said Atreyu. But even if they ride all night, they can't be here before morning.
Are they armed?
Asked Husbolt. I couldn't tell, said Atreyu. But there are more coming from other directions. I saw 6 in the west, 9 in the east, and 12 or 13 are coming from up ahead.
We'll wait and see what they want, said Hudorn. 35 or 36 men would hardly frighten the 3 of us, much less Sebastian and Atreyu.
Ordinarily, Bastian ungirt the sword Sikander before lying down to sleep, but that night he kept it on and slept with his hand on the hilt. In his dreams, he saw Moonchild smiling at him, and her smile seemed full of promise. If there was any more to the dream, he forgot it by the time he woke up, but his vision encouraged him in his hope of seeing her again. Glancing out the door of the cabin, he saw 7 blurred shapes through the mist that had risen from the river. 2 were on foot, the others mounted on different sorts of steeds. Bastian quietly awakened his companions. The knights unsheathed their swords, and together they stepped out of the cabin. When the figures waiting outside caught sight of Bastian, the riders dismounted, and all 7 went down on their left knees, bowed their heads, and cried out, "Hail and welcome to Bastian Balthazar Books, the savior of Fantastica!" The newcomers were a weird-looking lot. One of the 2 who had come on foot had an uncommonly long neck, and a head with 4 faces, one pointed in each of the 4 directions. The first was merry, the second angry, the third sad, and the fourth sleepy. All were rigid and unchanging, but he was able at any time to face forward with the one expressing his momentary mood. This individual was a 4-quarter troll, sometimes known as a moody woody. The second pedestrian was what is known in Fantastica as a head-footer. His head was connected directly with his long, thin legs, there being neither neck nor trunk. Head-footers are always on the go and have no fixed residence. As a rule, they roam about in swarms of many hundreds, but from time to time one runs across a loner. They feed on herbs and grasses. The one that was kneeling to Bastian looked young and red-cheeked. The 3 creatures riding on horses no larger than goats were a gnome, a shadow scamp, and a blondie cat. The gnome had a golden circlet around his head and was obviously a prince. The shadow scamp was hard to recognize because, to all intents and purposes, it consisted only of a shadow cast by no one. The blondie cat had a cat-like face and long, golden blonde curls that clothed her like a coat. Her whole body was covered with equally blonde, shaggy fur. She was no bigger than a 5-year-old child. Another, who was riding an ox, came from the land of the Sassafranians, who are born old and die when they have grown, that is, dwindled, to infancy. This one had a long white beard, a bald head, and a heavily wrinkled face. By Sassafranian standards, he was a youngster, about Bastian's age. A blue djinn had come on a camel. He was tall and thin, and was wearing an enormous turban. His shape was human, but his bare torso, with its bulging muscles, seemed to be made of some glossy blue metal. Instead of a nose and mouth, he had a huge, hooked eagle's beak.
"Who are you, and what do you want?"
Hukrian asked rather brusquely. Despite the ceremonious greeting, he wasn't quite convinced of the visitor's friendly intentions. He still had his hand on his sword hilt. The four-quarter troll, who up until then had been keeping his sleepy face foremost, now switched to the merry one. Ignoring Hukrian, he addressed himself to Bastian.
"Your lordship," he declared, "we are princes from many different parts of Fantastica, and we have all come to welcome you and ask for your help. The news of your presence has flown from country to country. The wind and the clouds speak your name, the waves of the sea proclaim your glory, and every last brooklet is celebrating your power."
Bastian cast a glance at Atreyu, but Atreyu looked at the troll unsmilingly and almost severely.
"We know,"
the blue djinn broke in, and his voice sounded like the rasping cry of an eagle.
"We know that you created Perilin, the Night Forest, and Goab, the Desert of Colors. We know that you have eaten and drunk the fire of the many-colored death and bathed in it. Something that no one else in Fantastica could have done and still lived. We know that you passed through the Temple of a Thousand Doors. And we know what happened in the Silver City of Amaganth. We know, my lord, that there is nothing you cannot do. When you make a wish, your wish comes to pass. And so we invite you to come and stay with us and favor us with a story of our own. For none of our nations has a story."
Bastian thought it over, then shook his head. "I can't do what you ask of me just yet. I'll help you later on. But first I must go to the Childlike Empress. I hope you will join us and help me find the Ivory Tower." The creatures didn't seem at all disappointed. After brief deliberation, they agreed to accompany Bastian on his journey. Whereupon the procession, which by now had the look of a small caravan, started out again. Throughout the day, they were joined by new adherents, not only those Atreyu had sighted the day before, but many more. There were goat-legged fawns and gigantic night hobs. There were elves and kobolds, beetle riders in three-legses, a man-sized rooster in jackboots, a stag with golden antlers who walked erect and wore a Prince Albert. Many of the new arrivals bore no resemblance whatsoever to human beings. There were helmeted copper ants, strangely shaped wandering rocks, flute birds who made music with their long beaks, and there were three so-called paddlers who moved by dissolving into a puddle at every step and resuming their usual life form a little farther on. But perhaps the most startling of all was a twee, whose fore and hindquarters had a way of running about independently of one another. Except for its red and white stripes, it looked rather like a hippopotamus. Soon the procession numbered at least 100, and all had come to welcome Bastian, the savior of Fantastica, and beg him for a story of their own. But the original 7 told the others that they would first have to go to the Ivory Tower, and all were agreed. Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudon rode with Bastian in the lead of the now rather impressive procession. Toward evening they came to a waterfall. Leaving the plateau, they made their way down a winding mountain trail, at the end of which they found themselves in a forest of tree-sized orchids with enormous spotted blossoms. These blossoms looked so frightening that when the travellers stopped for the night, they decided to post sentries. Bastian and Atreyu gathered some of the deep, soft moss that lay all about and made themselves a comfortable bed. Falkor protected the two friends by lying down in a circle around them. The air was warm and heavy with the strange and none too pleasant scent of the orchids. That scent seemed fraught with evil. 20. The Seeing Hand. The dewdrops on the orchids glistened in the morning sun as the caravan started out again. The night had been uneventful, except that more and more emissaries kept trailing in. The procession now numbered close to 300. The farther they went into the orchid forest, the stranger grew the shapes and colours of the flowers. And soon Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudurn discovered that the fears which had led them to post sentries had not been entirely groundless. For many of the orchids were carnivorous and big enough to swallow a whole calf. True, they could not move of their own volition, and it hadn't really been necessary to post sentries. But if something or someone touched them, they snapped shut like traps. And several times, when a blossom seized the hand, foot, or mount of a fellow traveller, the knights were obliged to draw their swords and hack the blossom to pieces. Throughout the ride, Bastian was besieged by all sorts of fantastic creatures who tried to attract his attention, or at least get a look at him. But Bastian rode on in withdrawn silence. A new wish had come to him, and for the first time it was one that made him seem standoffish and almost sullen. He felt that despite their reconciliation, Atreyu and Falcor were treating him like a child, that they felt responsible for him and thought he had to be led by the nose. But come to think of it, hadn't they been that way from the start? Oh yes, they were friendly enough, but they seemed to feel superior to him for some reason, to regard him as a harmless innocent who needed protecting. And that didn't suit him at all. He wasn't innocent, he wasn't harmless, and he'd soon show them. He wanted to be dangerous, dangerous and feared. Feared by all, including Atreyu and Falcor. The blue djinn, his name incidentally was Ilwan, elbowed his way through the crush around Bastian, crossed his arms over his chest, and bowed. Bastian stopped. "What is it, Ilwan? Speak."
"My lord," said the djinn, in his eagle's voice, "I've been listening in on the conversations of our new travelling companions. Some of them claim to know this part of the country, and their teeth are chattering with fear."
"What are they afraid of?"
"This forest of carnivorous orchids, my lord, belongs to Kseid, the wickedest and most powerful sorceress in all Fantastica. She lives in Horok Castle, also known as the Seeing Hand."
"Tell the scaredy-cats not to worry," said Bastian. "I'm here to protect them." Ilwan bowed and left him. A little later, Falcor and Atreyu, who had flown far ahead, returned to Bastian. The procession had stopped for the noonday meal.
"I don't know what to make of it," said Atreyu. 3 or 4 hours' journey from here, in the middle of the orchid forest, we saw a building that looks like a big hand jutting out of the ground. There's something sinister about it, and it's directly in our line of march."
Bastian told them what he had heard from Ilwan.
"If that's the case," said Atreyu, "wouldn't it be more sensible to change our direction?"
"No," said Bastian.
"But there's no reason why we should tangle with this Kazeide. I think we should steer clear of her."
"There is a reason," said Bastian.
"What reason?"
"Because I feel like it," said Bastian. Atreyu looked at him open-mouthed. The conversation stopped there, because Fantasticans were crowding in from all sides to get a look at Bastian. When the meal was over, Atreyu rejoined Bastian. Trying to make it sound casual, he suggested, "How about taking a ride with Falcor and me?" Bastian realized that Atreyu wanted a private talk with him. They hoisted themselves up on Falcor's back, Atreyu in front, Bastian behind him, and the dragon took off. It was the first time the two friends had flown together. Once they were airborne, Atreyu said, "It's been hard seeing you alone these days, but we have to talk things over, Bastian."
"Just as I thought," said Bastian with a smile. "What's on your mind?"
Atreyu began hesitantly.
"Have we come to this place, and are we heading where we are, because of some new wish of yours?"
"I imagine so," said Bastian rather coldly.
"That's what Falcor and I have been thinking," said Atreyu.
"What kind of wish is it?"
Bastian made no answer.
Don't get me wrong, said Atreo. It's not that we're afraid of anything or anyone, but we're your friends, and we worry about you.
No need to, said Bastian, still more coldly.
Falcor twisted his neck and looked back at them.
Atreo, he said, has a sensible suggestion. I advise you to listen to him, Bastian Balthazar Books.
Some more of your good advice? Said Bastian, with a sardonic smile. No, Bastian, said Atreo, no advice, a suggestion. You may not like it at first, but think it over before you turn it down. We want to help you, and we've been wondering how. The whole trouble is the way the childlike Empress's amulet affects you. Without Orin's power, you can't wish yourself ahead. But with Orin's power, you're losing yourself and forgetting where you want to go. Pretty soon, unless we do something about it, you won't have any idea where you're going.
We've already been through that, said Bastian.
So what? When I was wearing the gem, said Atreo, it was entirely different. It guided me, and it didn't take anything away from me. Maybe because I'm not a human, and I have no memory of the human world to lose. In other words, it helped me, and it did me no harm. So, here's what I suggest. Let me have Orin, and trust me to guide you. What do you say?
Bastian replied instantly, I say no. Again, Falcor looked back.
Couldn't you at least think it over for a moment?
No, said Bastian.
For the first time, Atreo grew angry.
Bastian, he said, think sensibly. You can't go on like this. Haven't you noticed that you've changed completely? You're not yourself anymore.
Thanks, said Bastian. Thank you very much for minding my business all the time. But frankly, I can get along without your advice.
In case you've forgotten, I saved Fantastica, and Moonchild entrusted her power to me. She must have had some reason for it, because she could have let you keep Orin. But she took it away from you and gave it to me.
I've changed, you say. Yes, my dear Atreo, you may be right. I'm no longer the harmless innocent you take me for.
Shall I tell you the real reason you want me to give up Orin? Because you're just plain jealous. You don't know me yet, but if you go on like this, you'll get to know me.
Atreo did not reply.
Falcor's flight had suddenly lost all its buoyancy. He seemed to be dragging himself through the air, sinking lower and lower like a wounded bird. At length, Atreo spoke with difficulty. Bastian, he said, you can't seriously believe what you've said.
Let's forget about it. As far as I'm concerned, you never said it.
All right, said Bastian. Let's forget it. Anyway, I didn't start the argument.
For a time, they rode on in silence. In the distance, Horrock Castle rose up from the orchid forest. It really did look like a giant hand with five outstretched fingers.
But there's something I want to make clear once and for all, said Bastian suddenly. I've made up my mind. I'm not going back at all. I'm going to stay in Fantastica for good. I like it here, so I can manage without my memories. And if it's the future of Fantastica you're worried about, I can give Moonchild thousands of new names. We don't need the human world anymore.
Falcor banked for a U-turn.
Hey! Bastian shouted. What are you doing? Fly ahead! I want to see Horrock close up!
I can't, Falcor gasped. I honestly can't go on.
On their return to the caravan, they found their travelling companions in a frenzy of agitation. They had been attacked by a band of some 50 giants, covered with black armour that made them look like enormous two-legged beetles. Many of the travelling companions had fled, and were just beginning to return singly or in groups. Others had done their best to defend themselves, but had been no match for the armoured giants. The three knights, Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudorn,
had fought heroically, but without making a dent in any of their assailants. In the end, they had been disarmed and dragged away in chains. One of the armored giants had shouted in a strangely metallic voice,
"Xeide, the mistress of Horok Castle, sends greetings to Bastian Balthazar Books, the savior of Fantastica, and makes the following demands. Submit to me unconditionally, and swear to serve me with body and soul as my faithful slave. Should you refuse, or should you attempt to circumvent my will, by guile or stratagem, your three friends Huclion, Husbolt, and Hudorn will die a slow, shameful, and cruel death by torture. You have until sunrise tomorrow to make up your mind." That is the message of Kaseide, the mistress of Horok Castle. It has been duly delivered.
Bastian bit his lips. Atreyu and Falkor had wiped all expression off their faces, but Bastian knew exactly what they were thinking. What he minded most was their mask of secrecy. But this was hardly the time to have it out with them. That could wait. Instead, he addressed the company in a loud voice. "I will never give in to Xeide's blackmail. We must set the prisoners free, and without delay."
"It won't be easy," said Ilwan, the blue djinn with the eagle beak. "All of us together are no match for those black devils. And even if you, my lord, and Atreyu and his luck dragon were to lead us into battle, it would take us too long to capture Horok Castle. The lives of the three knights are in Kaseide's hands. She will kill them the moment she finds out that we are attacking."
"Then we mustn't let her find out," said Bastian. "We must take her by surprise."
"How can we do that?" asked the four-quarter troll, putting forward his angry face, which was rather terrifying.
"Kaseide is crafty. I'm sure she has an answer for anything we can think up."
"I agree," said the Prince of the Gnomes. "There are too many of us. If we move on to Horok Castle, she's sure to know it. Even at night, so large a troop movement can't be kept secret. She has her spies."
"Good," said Bastian. "We'll fool her with the help of her spies."
"How can we do that, my lord?"
"The rest of you will start off in a different direction, to make her think we've given up trying to free the prisoners, and we're running away."
"And what will become of the prisoners?"
"I'll attend to that, with Atreyu and Falkor."
"Just the three of you?"
"Yes," said Bastian. "That is, if Atreyu and Falkor agree to come with me. If not, I'll go alone." The travelling companions looked at him with admiration. Those closest to him passed his words on to those farther back in the crowd.
"My lord," the blue djinn cried out, "regardless of whether you conquer or die, this will go down in the history of Fantastica."
Bastian turned to Atreyu and Falkor. "Are you coming, or have you got some more of your suggestions?"
"We're coming," said Atreyu.
"In that case," Bastian agreed, "the caravan must start moving while it's still light. You must hurry. Make it look as if you were in flight. We'll wait here until dark. We'll join you tomorrow morning, with the three knights or not at all. Go now." After taking a respectful leave of Bastian, the travelling companion started out. Bastian, Atreyu and Falkor hid in a clump of orchid trees and waited for nightfall. In the late afternoon, a faint jangling was heard, and five of the black giants approached the abandoned camp. They seemed to be all of black metal. Even their faces were like iron masks, and their movements were strangely mechanical. All stopped at once, all looked in the direction where the caravan had gone. Then, without a word, all marched off in step.
"My plan seems to be working," Bastian whispered. "There were only five," said Atreyu.
Where are the others? The five are sure to communicate with the rest, said Bastian. At length, when it was quite dark, Bastian, Atreyu, and Falkor crept from their hiding place, and Falkor rose soundlessly into the air with his two riders. Flying as low as possible over the orchid forest to avoid being seen, he headed in the direction they had taken that afternoon. The darkness was impenetrable, and they wondered how they would ever find the castle. But a few minutes later, Horok appeared before them in a blaze of light. There seemed to be a lamp in every one of its thousand windows. Evidently, Kaseide wanted her castle to be seen. But that was only reasonable, for she was expecting Bastian's visit. A different sort of visit, to be sure. To be on the safe side, Falkor glided to the ground among the orchids, for his pearly white scales would have reflected the glow of the castle. Under cover of the trees, they approached. Outside the gate, 10 of the armored guards were on watch, and at each of the brightly lit windows stood one of them, black, motionless, and menacing. Horok Castle was situated on a rise from which the orchid trees had been cleared. True enough, it was shaped like an enormous hand. Each finger was a tower, and the thumb was an aureole, surmounted by yet another tower. The whole building was many stories high, and the windows were like glittering eyes looking out over the countryside. It was known with good reason as the Seeing Hand.
The first thing we have to do, Bastian whispered into Atreyu's ear, is locate the prisoners.
Atreyu nodded and told Bastian to stay there with Falkor. Then he crawled soundlessly away. He was gone a long time. When he returned, he reported,
I've been all around the castle. There's only this one entrance, and it's too well guarded. But I've discovered a skylight high up at the tip of the middle finger that seems to be unguarded. Falkor could easily take us up there, but we'd be seen. The prisoners are probably in the cellar. At any rate, I heard a long scream of pain that seemed to come from deep down.
Bastian thought hard. Then he whispered,
I'll try to reach that skylight. Meanwhile, you and Falkor must keep the guards busy. Make them think we're trying to get in by the gate, but don't do any more. Don't get into a fight. Keep them here as long as you can. Give me a few minutes' time before you do anything.
Atreyu pressed his friend's hand in silence. Then Bastian took off his silver mantle and slipped away through the darkness. He'd almost circled the castle when he heard Atreyu shouting,
Attention! Bastian Balthazar Books, the savior of Fantastica, is here. He has come not to beg Kaseide for mercy, but to give her a last chance to release the prisoners. If she sets them free, her miserable life will be spared.
Looking around the corner of the castle, Bastian caught a glimpse of Atreyu, who had put on the silver mantle and coiled his blue-black hair into a kind of turban. To anyone who didn't know the two boys very well, there was a certain resemblance between them. For a moment, the armored giant seemed undecided. Then Bastian could hear in the distance the metallic stamping of their feet as they rushed at Atreyu. The shadows in the windows also began to move as the guards left their posts to see what was going on. And many more of the armored giants poured out through the gates. When the first had almost reached Atreyu, he slipped nimbly away and a moment later appeared over their heads, riding Falkor. The armored giants brandished their swords and leapt high in the air, but they couldn't reach him. Bastian started climbing the wall. Here and there he was helped by outcroppings and window ledges, but more often he had to hold fast with his fingertips. Higher and higher he climbed. Once the jutting stone he had set his foot on crumbled away and left him hanging by one hand, but he pulled himself up, found a hold for his other hand, and kept climbing. When at last he reached the towers, he made better progress, for they were so close together that he could push himself up by bracing himself between them. At length he reached the skylight and slipped through. True enough,
There was no guard in the tower room. Heaven knows why. Opening a door, he came to a narrow winding staircase and started down. When he reached the floor below, he saw two black guards standing at a window, watching the excitement outside. He managed to pass behind them without attracting their notice. On he crept, down more stairways, through passages and corridors. One thing was certain. Those armored giants might have been great fighters, but they didn't amount to much as guards. At last, the cold and the musty smell told him he was in the cellar. Luckily, all the guards seemed to have raced upstairs in pursuit of the supposed Bastian Balthazar books. Torches along the walls lit the way for him. Lower and lower he went. He had the impression that there were as many floors below the ground as above. Finally, he came to the bottommost cellar, and soon found the dungeon where Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudorn were languishing. It was a pitiful sight. They were hanging by their wrists over what seemed to be a bottomless pit. The long iron chains that held them were connected by way of overhead rollers with a winch, but the winch was fastened with a great padlock and couldn't be budged. Bastian stood, perplexed. The three prisoners' eyes were closed. They seemed to be asleep or unconscious. Then Hudorn the Enduring opened his left eye and sang out, "Hey, friends, look who's here!" The others managed to open their eyes, and a smile crossed their lips.
"We knew you wouldn't leave us in the lurch," cried Hudorn.
"How can I get you down?" Bastian asked. "The winch is locked."
"Just take your sword and cut the chains," said Husbald. "And drop us into the pit," said Hukrion. "That's not such a good idea."
"Anyway," said Bastian, "I can't draw my sword. I can't use Sikander unless it jumps into my hand."
"That's the trouble with magic swords," said Hudorn. "When you need them, they go on strike."
"Hey," Husbald whispered, "the guards had the key to that winch. Where could they have put it?"
"I remember a loose stone," said Hukrion, "but I couldn't see very well while they were hoisting me up here."
Bastian looked and looked. The light was dim and flickering, but after a while he discovered a stone flag that was not quite even with the rest. He lifted it cautiously, and there indeed was the key. He opened the big padlock and removed it from the winch. Then slowly he began to turn. It creaked and groaned so loud that the armored giants must have heard it by then if they weren't totally deaf. Even so, there was nothing to be gained by stopping. Bastian went on turning until the three knights were level with the floor, though still over the pit. Then, after swinging them to and fro until their feet touched the ground, he let them down. They stretched out exhausted and showed no inclination to move. Besides, they still had the heavy chains on their wrists. Bastian had little time to think, for metallic steps came clanking down the stone stairs. The guards! Their armor glittered in the torchlight like the carapaces of giant insects. All with the same movement, they drew their swords and rushed at Bastian. Then, at last, Sikander leapt from the rusty sheath and into his hand. With the speed of lightning, the blade attacked the first of the armored giants and hacked him to pieces before Bastian himself knew what was happening. It was then that he saw what the giants were made of. They were hollow shells of armor. There was nothing inside. He had no time to wonder what made them move. Bastian was in a good position, for only one giant at a time could squeeze through the narrow doorway of the dungeon. And one at a time, Sikander chopped them to bits. Soon their remains lay piled up on the floor like enormous black eggshells. After some 20 of them had been disposed of, the rest withdrew, evidently in the hope of waylaying Bastian in a position more favorable to themselves. Taking advantage of the breathing spell, Bastian let Sikander cut the shackles from the knight's wrists. Hukrion and Hudorn dragged themselves to their feet and tried to draw their swords,
which strangely enough had not been taken away from them. But their hands were numb from the long hanging, and refused to obey them. Husbald, the most delicate of the three, wasn't even able to stand by himself. His two friends had to hold him up. "Never mind," said Bastian. "Sikander needs no help. Just stay behind me, and don't get in my way." They left the dungeon, slowly climbed the stairs, and came to a large hall. Suddenly all the torches went out, but Sikander shone bright. Again they heard the heavy metallic tread of many armored giants.
"Quick," cried Bastian, "back to the stairs. This is where I'm going to fight."
He couldn't see whether the three knights obeyed his order, and there was no time to find out, because Sikander was already dancing in his hand. The entire hall was ablaze with its sharp white light. The assailants managed to push Bastian back from the top of the stairs and to attack him from all sides, yet not one of their mighty blows touched him. Sikander whirled around him so fast that it looked like hundreds of swords, and a few moments later he was surrounded by a heap of shattered black armor, in which nothing stirred.
"Come on up!" Bastian cried to his companions.
The three knights stood gaping on the stairs. Hukrian's moustache was trembling.
"I've never seen anything like it," he cried.
"Something to tell my grandchildren," Husbald stammered.
"The only trouble," said Hudorn mournfully, "is that they won't believe you."
Bastian stood there with sword in hand, wondering what to do next. Suddenly, it sprang back into its sheath.
"The danger seems to be over," he said.
"At least the part that calls for a sword," said Hudorn. "What do we do now?"
"Now," said Bastian, "I want to make this Kseid's acquaintance. I've got a bone to pick with her."
After climbing several more flights of stairs, Bastian and the knights reached the ground floor, where Atreyu and Falkor were waiting for them, in a kind of lobby.
"Well done, you two,"
cried Bastian, slapping Atreyu on the back.
"What's become of the armored giants?" asked Atreyu.
"Hollow shells," said Bastian contemptuously.
"Where's Kaseide?"
"Up in her magic throne room," answered Atreyu.
"Come along," said Bastian, taking the silver mantle which Atreyu held out to him.
And all together, including Falkor, they climbed the broad stairway leading to the upper floors. When Bastian, followed by his companions, entered the magic throne room, Kaseide arose from her red coral throne. She was wearing a long gown of violet silk, and her flaming red hair was coiled and braided into a fantastic edifice. Her face and her long, thin hands were as pale as marble. There was something strangely disturbing about her eyes. It took Bastian a few moments to figure out what it was. They were of different colors, one green, one red. She was trembling, evidently in fear of Bastian. He looked her straight in the face, and she lowered her long lashes. The room was full of weird objects whose purpose it was hard to determine. There were large globes covered with designs, sidereal clocks, and pendulums hanging from the ceiling. There were costly censers from which rose heavy clouds of different colored smoke, which crept over the floor like fog. Thus far, Bastian hadn't said a word. That seemed to shatter Xeide's composure, as suddenly she threw herself on the floor in front of him, took one of his feet, and set it on her neck.
"My lord and master," she said, in a deep voice that sounded somehow mysterious, "no one in Phantastica can withstand you. You are mightier than the mighty, and more dangerous than all the demons together. If you wish to take revenge on me for being too stupid to recognize your greatness, trample me underfoot. I have earned your anger. But if you wish once again to demonstrate your far-famed magnanimity, Suffer me to become your obedient slave, who swears to obey you body and soul. Teach me to do what you deem desirable, and I will be your humble pupil, obedient to your every hint. I repent of the harm I tried to do you, and beg your mercy.
Arise, Xeide, said Bastian. He had been very angry, but her speech pleased him. If she had really acted out of ignorance, and really regretted it so bitterly, then it was beneath his dignity to punish her. And since she even wished to learn what he deemed desirable, he could see no reason to reject her plea. Xeide rose and stood before him with bowed head. "Will you obey me unconditionally?" he asked. "However hard you may find it to do my bidding, will you obey me without argument and without grumbling?"
"I will, my lord and master," said Xeide. "You will see there is nothing we cannot accomplish if we combine my artifices and your power."
"Very well," said Bastian. "Then I will take you into my service. You will leave this castle and go with me to the Ivory Tower, where I am expecting to meet Moonchild." For a fraction of a second, Xeide's eyes glowed red and green, but then, veiling them with her long lashes, she said,
"I am yours to command, my lord and master."
Thereupon all descended the stairs. Once outside the castle, Bastian observed, "The first thing to do is find our travelling companions. Goodness knows where they are."
"Not very far from here," said Xeide. "I've led them slightly astray."
"For the last time," said Bastian.
"For the last time," she agreed. "But how will we get there? Do you expect me to walk through the woods and at night?"
"Falcor will carry us," said Bastian. "He's strong enough to carry us all."
Falcor raised his head and looked at Bastian. His ruby-red eyes glittered.
"I'm strong enough, Bastian Balthazar Books," boomed the bronze bell-like voice. "But I will not carry that woman."
"Oh, yes, you will," said Bastian, "because I command it." The Luck Dragon looked at Atreu, who nodded almost imperceptibly. But Bastian had seen that nod. All took their places on Falcor's back, and he rose into the air.
"Which way?" he asked.
"Straight ahead," said Xeide.
"Which way?"
Falcor asked again, as if he hadn't heard.
"Straight ahead," Bastian shouted. "You heard her."
"Do as she says," said Atreu under his breath. And Falcor complied. Half an hour later, already the dawn was greying. They saw innumerable campfires down below, and the Luck Dragon landed. In the meantime, many more Fantasticans had turned up, and a lot of them had brought tents. The camp spread out on a wide, flower-strewn meadow at the edge of the orchid forest, looked like a tent city.
"How many are you now?" Bastian asked.
Ilwan, the blue djinn, who had taken charge of the caravan in Bastian's absence, replied that he had not yet been able to make an exact count, but that he guessed they were close to 1,000.
"And there's something else to report," he added. "Something rather strange. Soon after we pitched camp, shortly before midnight, 5 of those armored giants appeared. But they were peaceful, and they've kept to themselves. Of course, no one dared go near them. They brought a big litter made of red coral, but it was empty."
"Those are my carriers," said Xeide in a pleading tone to Bastian. "I sent them ahead last night. That's the pleasantest way to travel, if it does not displease you, my lord."
"I don't like the look of this," Atreu interrupted.
"Why not?" said Bastian. "What's your objection?"
"She can travel any way she likes," said Atreu dryly. but she wouldn't have sent her litter here last night if she hadn't known in advance that she'd be coming here. She had planned the whole thing. Your victory was really a defeat. She purposely let you win. That was her way of winning you over.
Enough of this, cried Bastian, purple with anger. I didn't ask for your opinion. You make me sick with your lecturing. And now you question my victory and ridicule my magnanimity.
Atreyu was going to say something, but Bastian screamed at him, Shut up and leave me be! If the two of you aren't satisfied with what I do and the way I am, go away! I'm not keeping you! Go where you please! I'm sick of you!
Bastian folded his arms over his chest and turned his back on Atreyu. The Fantasticans who had gathered around were dumbfounded. For a time, Atreyu stood silent. Up until then, Bastian had never reprimanded him in the presence of others. He was so stunned he could hardly breathe. He waited a while, then when Bastian did not turn back to him, he slowly walked away. Falcor followed him. Zayd smiled. It wasn't a pleasant smile. In that moment, Bastian's memory of having been a child in his world was effaced. 21. The Star Cloister. Uninterruptedly, new emissaries from all parts of Fantastica poured in to swell the army of those accompanying Bastian on his march to the Ivory Tower. It proved impossible to take a count because new ones kept arriving while the counting was in progress. Each morning, an army several thousand strong got underway, and each night it set up the strangest tent city imaginable. Since Bastian's traveling companions varied enormously in shape and size, some of their night lodgings might have been mistaken for circus tents, while others at the opposite end of the scale were no bigger than a thimble. Their vehicles also showed astonishing variety, ranging from common covered wagons and diligences to the most extraordinary rolling barrels, bouncing balls, and crawling containers with automotive legs. Of all the tents, the most magnificent was the one that had been procured for Bastian. The shape and size of a small house, it was made of lustrous, many-colored silk, embroidered with gold and silver. A flag affixed to the roof was decorated with Bastian's coat of arms, a seven-armed candelabrum. The inside was furnished with soft blankets and cushions. Bastian's tent was always set up at the center of the camp, and the blue djinn, who had become his factotum, stood guard at the entrance. Atreyu and Falcor were still among the host of Bastian's companions, but since the public reprimand, he hadn't exchanged a word with them. Secretly, he was waiting for Atreyu to give in and apologize. But Atreyu did nothing of the kind, nor did Falcor show any inclination to humble himself before Bastian. And that, said Bastian to himself, was just what they must learn to do. If they expected him to back down, they had another think coming. His will was of steel. But if they gave in, he'd welcome them with open arms. If Atreyu knelt down to him, he would lift him up and say, Don't kneel to me, Atreyu. You are and remain my friend. But for the time being, Atreyu and Falcor brought up the rear of the procession. Falcor seemed to have forgotten how to fly. He trudged along on foot, and Atreyu walked beside him, most of the time with bowed head. A sad come-down for the proud reconnaissance flyers. Bastian wasn't happy about it, but there was nothing he could do. He began to be bored riding the mule Yika in the lead of the caravan, and took to visiting Zayd in her litter instead. She received him with a great show of respect, gave him the most comfortable seat, and squatted down at his feet. She could always think of something interesting to talk about, and when she noticed that he disliked speaking of his past in the human world, she stopped questioning him about it. Most of the time, she smoked her oriental water pipe. The stem looked like an emerald green viper, and the mouthpiece, which she held between her marble-white fingers,
suggested a snake's head. She seemed to be kissing it as she smoked. The clouds of smoke which poured indolently from her mouth and nose changed colour with every puff, from blue to yellow to pink to green and so on. "Gzeide," said Bastian on one of his visits, looking thoughtfully at the armoured giants who were carrying the litter, "there's something I've been wanting to ask you."
"Your slave is listening," said Gzeide.
"When I fought your guards," said Bastian, "I discovered that there was nothing inside their shell of armour. So what makes them move?"
"My will," said Gzeide with a smile. "It's because they're empty that they do my will. My will can control anything that's empty."
She turned her red and green gaze on Bastian. For a moment it gave him a strangely eerie feeling, but quickly she lowered her lashes.
"Could I control them with my will?" he asked. "Of course you could, my lord and master," he replied. "You could do it 100 times better than I. I am as nothing beside you. Would you care to try?"
"Not now," said Bastian, who was rather frightened at the idea. "Maybe some other time."
"Tell me," said Gzeide, "do you really enjoy riding an old mule? Wouldn't you rather be carried by beings you can move with your will?"
"But Ika likes to carry me," said Bastian almost peevishly. "It gives her pleasure."
"Then you do it to please her?"
"Why not?" said Bastian. "What's wrong with that?" Gzeide let some green smoke rise from her mouth.
"Oh, nothing at all, my lord. How can anything you do be wrong?"
"What are you driving at, Gzeide?"
She bowed her head of flaming red hair. "You think of others too much, my lord and master," he whispered. "No one is worthy to divert your attention from your own all-important development. If you promise not to be angry, I will venture a piece of advice. Think more of your own perfection."
"What has that got to do with Yika?"
"Not much, my lord. Hardly anything. Just this. She's not a worthy mount for someone as important as you. It grieves me to see you riding such an undistinguished animal. All your travelling companions are surprised. You alone, my lord and master, seem unaware of what you owe to yourself."
Bastian said nothing, but Gzeide's words had made an impression. Next day, as the procession with Bastian and Yika in the lead was passing through lush rolling meadows, interspersed here and there by small copses of fragrant lilac, he decided to take Zayid's advice. At noon, when the caravan stopped to rest, he patted the old mule on the neck and said, "Yika, the time has come for us to part." Yika let out a cry of dismay.
"Why, master," she asked, "have I done my job so badly?"
And tears flowed from the corners of her dark eyes.
"Not at all," Bastian hastened to reassure her. "You've been carrying me so gently all this time, you've been so patient and willing, that I've decided to reward you."
"I don't want any other reward," said Yika. "I just want to go on carrying you. How could I wish for anything better?"
"Didn't you once tell me it made you sad that mules can't have children?"
"Yes," said Yika, "because when I'm very old, I'd like to tell my children about these happy days."
"Very well," said Bastian. "Then I'll tell you a story that will come true. And I'll tell it only to you and no one else, because it's your story."
Then he took hold of one of Yika's long ears and whispered into it.
"Not far from here, in a little lilac copse, the father of your son is waiting for you. He's a white stallion with the white wings of a swan. His mane and his tail are so long they touch the ground. He has been following you secretly for days, because he's immortally in love with you.
With me?
Cried Yika, almost frightened. But I'm only a mule, and I'm not as young as I used to be. In his eyes, said Bastian in an undertone, you're the most beautiful creature in all Fantastica, just as you are. And also, perhaps, because you've carried me. But he's very bashful. He doesn't dare approach you with all these creatures about. You must go to him, or he'll die of longing for you.
My, oh my, Yika sighed. Is it as bad as all that?
Yes, Bastian whispered in her ear. And now, goodbye, Yika. Just run along. You'll find him. Yika took a few steps, but then she looked back again.
Frankly, she said, I'm kind of scared.
There's nothing to worry about, said Bastian with a smile. And don't forget to tell your children and grandchildren about me.
Thank you, Master,
said Yika. And off she went. For a long while, Bastian looked after her as she hobbled off. He wasn't really happy about sending her away. He went to his luxurious tent, lay down on the soft cushions, and gazed at the ceiling. He kept telling himself that he had made Yika's dearest wish come true, but that didn't make him feel any better. A person's reason for doing someone a good turn matters as much as the good turn itself. But that made no difference to Yika, for she really did find the white-winged stallion. They married, and she had a son who was a white-winged mule. His name was Pataplan, and he made quite a name for himself in Fantastica. But that's another story, and shall be told another time. From then on, Bastian travelled in Xeide's litter. She even offered to get out and walk alongside, so as to give him every possible comfort. But that was more than Bastian would accept. So they sat together in the comfortable red coral litter, which from then on led the procession. Bastian was still rather gloomy, and felt a certain resentment toward Xeide for persuading him to part with his mule. He kept answering her in monosyllables, so that no real conversation was possible. Xeide soon realized what the trouble was. To guide his thoughts into different channels, she said brightly,
I would like to make you a present, my lord and master, if you deign to accept one from me.
She rummaged under her cushions and found a richly ornamented casket. As Bastian tingled with eagerness, she opened it and took out a belt with chain links. Each link, as well as the clasp, was made of clear glass.
What is it?
Bastian asked.
It's a belt that makes its wearer invisible. But if you want it to belong to you, my lord, you must give it its name.
Bastian examined it.
The belt